This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Tonight's show features an interview with Healdsburg, California Literary Laureate Vilma Ginsberg, and a reading by Dan Bellum, a San Francisco poet whose third book of poems, Practice, was published this year by 16 Rivers Press. I'll also play a recording of a poem by a former Healdsburg Literary Laureate, Armando Garcia Davila, and the late magnificent contralto, Kathleen Ferrier, singing the art song Down by the Sally Gardens, a poem by William Butler Yeats. First, Vilma Ginsberg. She's the author of two books of poems, Colors of Glass, published in 2004, and Murmurs and Outcries, which was just published last year, 2007. She has also co-edited an anthology with Doug Stout called Present at the Creation, Poets Write About Writing Poetry. Hi, Vilma.
Hello, Catherine.
It's nice to have you here again.
It's wonderful to be here again.
Yeah. You read a poem that you wrote for Doug Stout shortly after his passing, and I'll probably ask you to read that poem again later in the show. Before we talk about your books, I'd like to just focus on Vilma Ginsberg for a minute, just in case there's anyone listening who doesn't know who you are already. First of all, congratulations, because I understand you are Healdsburg's new literary laureate.
Thank you.
And what will you be doing as Healdsburg's literary laureate?
Oh, I think I'll pretty much be carrying on what I've been doing in the literary community in and around Healdsburg. First of all, I'm hosting the third Sunday Salon of the Healdsburg Literary Guild, which was begun actually in 2001, I think, by Chip Wendt, who was the laureate before me.
Uh-huh.
And he hosted it for six and a half years until he moved out of the area last year, a year and a half ago. And he thought it would die with his leaving. But we loved the venue so much and wanted to carry it on that we asked him if it was all right if the Literary Guild continued it. And I've been hosting it ever since, and I just love doing that. Mm-hmm. I love having a place where poets and writers can come to share their work and listen to each other and speak their piece. I have some other things that I'm excited about. I love reading out loud. Mm-hmm. I love hearing poetry read aloud. I love going to venues and hearing it. I love reading my own poetry. And I think that poetry should be read out loud more often and in more places. One of the reasons I love what you do, Catherine, with your Word Temple at Copperfields and the Word Temple here. I would like to see poetry readings being videotaped and put out on our public access TV stations, for example. So there are a number of things that I'm excited about. That's one of them.
Well, you are a first-generation American. I understand your parents were Hungarian immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
And your father played violin, and did he also work in a coal mine?
He did. You know, he was actually born here in Pennsylvania shortly after his mother arrived. What happened was similar to what is happening today with immigrants. The fathers come to this country, get a job, make some money, enough money to bring the mothers and the children over. And both of my grandfathers did that. My father, however, was born here. My mother was born in Hungary and came here at three. I am writing stories, family stories for my granddaughter. I've been doing that for the last decade or so. And one of the stories I write is based on what my mother told me about her memories when she was 3 years old coming through Ellis Island and seeing her father for the first time in her life, how her mother pointed her father out on the other side of the chain link fence and said, "See the man with the little brown bag? That's your father. See him waving the bag? Wave to him." And my mother remembers waving to him, and that the little brown bag had hard candies in it.
You describe yourself as an early feminist. You went to Douglas College of Rutgers University What year was that, Vilma?
How much of
an early feminist are you?
Well, I actually started college in 1944, which was before the war, Second World War ended. Mm-hmm. I remember where I was when we got the news in 1945 that the war was over. Married in 52, was widowed in 56. And after being widowed, went to graduate school as a single parent, working part-time and being supported by the insurance money of my husband to get my own career. So that was in the 50s that I was a single working graduate school parent without the support systems that we now have in place for women.
When you were in college, you spent one summer working at Rockland State Hospital, and that was the year after The Snake Pit was written, and that was later made into a movie in 1948.
I remember it well.
Olivia de Havilland.
You're right.
And what did you see there, and how did this experience shape your life?
I was a psychology major in undergraduate college and had to work summers. And was pointed by my major professor toward the American Friends Service Committee. I was in New Jersey. The Quakers were headquartered in Philadelphia, which was not far away. And I looked them up. They were sponsoring units, groups of college students working for the summers in places where other people did not want to work, where some light and love needed to be brought. We didn't have to be Quakers to work with them, but I worked with them. That's how I got to the Rockland State Hospital. There was a unit of about 60 of us college students who worked there for the summer in a place where it was a warehouse for the mentally ill. It was about an hour or so outside of New York City. It was filled with the most mentally ill of New York City's population. And it was a dismal, dismal place. It was a time before the antipsychotic medications, before the humane treatment of mental patients. And we had to learn how to simply sometimes just hold people down from their crazy behavior. There was no way of controlling the hallucinations they were having and so on. It was such a dismal place. It's true, it was a snake pit still when I was there. But that summer gelled my resolve that if things were going to change in the mental health field, they had to change from within. And that's when I decided that I would go into the field of psychology and work in the field of psychology to do what I could about that.
It seems almost impossible to be in an environment like that and not come away with some resolve, either to try to make it better or to just run like hell, you know, and avoid it for the rest of your life. You were married briefly to Raphael Ginsberg. He was a pioneering geriatric psychiatrist, but you just mentioned it was a very brief marriage.
It was a very brief marriage for a number of reasons. One was that when we married, part of his proposal to me included the fact that he had a severe heart condition and did not know how much longer he had to live, but that however long he had, he wanted to spend it with me if I would accept him under those conditions. I married him when I was 25 and he was 57. We had a little bit less than 4 years together and yielded a daughter, his first child ever. He walked around like he invented fatherhood, of course.
Oh, that's great. He's 57 years old.
Yes. And so it was a short but rich, wonderful, wonderful time with him. I have been, for the last decade or so, writing stories about him. He was a target and an escapee from Bolshevik Russia. He was a target and escapee from Nazi Germany and finally came to this country. He had a rich historical legacy. And I wanted to tell those stories to my granddaughter, mm-hmm. his granddaughter.
In Colors of Glass, you have your poems positioned so that in the beginning there are love poems. Are these poems addressed to him?
Actually, no.
Uh-huh.
I wrote most of these poems after he had passed. I was a young person. I was 29 when he died, and then I started graduate school. And I've had what I consider to be a rich and varied life, maybe layers of life. And writing was a way that I was expressing myself when I could not be public about some things. And a lot of the poems, many of the poems in Colors of Glass, especially in the love word section, but in some of the other sections also, were written at that time. And for that reason, they were just written because I needed to write them. Mm-hmm. I never expected anyone to see them. It's only now, 40 years later, 30 years later, 20 years later, mm-hmm. that I decided to put them out there.
Let's look at your book, Colors of Glass. It does begin with love poems, and it ends with poems on aging. And you have a type of preface in the book that's a list of quotes by the wonderful poet Lenore Kandel. She was a 50s and 60s San Francisco poet that I'm afraid not enough people know about. Mm-hmm. She was just awesome, and she was very against censorship of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
You have several quotes by her. Two of them are, "To compromise poetry through fear is to atrophy the psyche." And the other is, "Poetry is alive because it is a medium of vision and experience. It is not necessarily comfortable. It is not necessarily safe." So, Vilma, how is your own poetry not necessarily safe?
Oh, my. On a personal level, I suppose, poetry was my way of expressing some of the most intimate feelings and experiences that I was having that I did not feel free at the time to broadcast to not only the community, but to my family. I had a sensitive career in sensitive positions, and it was not the time. It didn't seem appropriate to me. But the poems had to be written. And Lenore Kandel's place where she stood about that spoke to me so strongly. I just do not believe that feelings and personal experiences can stand to be censored and should not be censored. And the expression of them through poetry should not be censored. So she spoke very deeply to things that I believed in. And so I quoted her in my preface.
Well, why don't you read some poems, starting with Encounter?
Encounter is maybe the earliest poem that I wrote that is in this collection. One of my early ones. And I have to say it's one of my favorite ones because it speaks to the experience that many of us have had of being touched in a very deep way, deeper than we know at the time, by some small experience with someone. You touched down like a flat stone skimming off my lake's shiny surface. And I, fluid, eager, reached for you as the water kisses the stone on its leaving. Now, my waverings of response dying, I become again placid. Little did I know how deeply you would settle in me.
Why don't you go ahead and just give us a mini reading?
Overture and Three Songs. I am tired of my silent orgasms, strangled in my smooth-sheeted bed. I am dying of rotting love sounds, swallowed and stifled, beating their life cries against the walls of my civility, caged by the rusty irons of self-consciousness. I want my loving to be a symphony in the wilderness. Song 1. Let me give myself to you beside the pulsing sea, where I can hear the rhythms of my being, my passion-pushing love thrusts ripple and grow like the sea's crescendo, beating, pulsing, crashing, merging, merging with the surf sounds, the drumbeat of the ages. And love me, take me thunderously, counting out with the heartbeat sea the now moments of our eternity, and ebb, and ebb, and ebb into Circe's peace. Song 2. Let me love you whisperingly, walking with you in the fir-hushed forest mazes, reverently, in those leafy, high-vaulted cathedrals, endless virgin redwoods, stippled by sun and shadow, nature's consecrated stained glass. Lying with you in buttercup fields with honey scents and gentle ladybugs, until the siren songs of oriole and hoot owl and silent echoes of wild gentian blowing call me to sing to you of soft rains, of butterflies, of waiting life in snow-clad winter trees, of sun and sweet berries, of bodies, souls, loving, sacred, free. Song 3. I hear the winds in rustling white ash tree tips calling me to love you. I hear the lovely lonely coyotes call, teaching my new freed life cries, love cries, to join the wild wolverine's wailings and hallelujah, sing, let me sing my love screams across the valleys, laughing, singing hallelujah through the flutes, the cymbals, the holy organs of my being, chanting hallelujah, I am free, hallelujah, I am living, I am being, hallelujah, I'm loving, loving, loudly loving. I am the music of the ages. Yes, God, I'm singing in the wilderness. And the trees are my chorus. And on a different note, vaccination, a very short piece. I regularly indulge in one or two small vices as prevention against holier-than-thou-itis, which is itself among the lethalest of vices. And this is the shadow side of growing older, the taste of bitter. It's the part that I see in some people as they get older, and every once in a while I taste in myself and don't like it, don't want it there. I am become too short and bent, too tentative of my step. I am become too slow where others rush. I am become too taut where they saunter. I am become the dreaded old. I am become that behind whose back I used to snicker in amused derision with others of my youth. The voice of that I am is crushed in the stampede of youth, the disdain of impatience. Thus could I become bitter with the old.
Thank you so much. Last year, your dear friend Doug Stout passed away, and we had a little short segment about Doug Stout on air on ARCB, and you read a beautiful poem that you wrote.
I wrote this poem. Yeah, I didn't think it was a poem. It was the feelings and thoughts I had when I was visiting him 3 days before he passed, not knowing he was going to pass then. It was an imagined conversation I was having with him as I saw him failing very fast. I wrote these words down, and on the day that I visited him 3 days later, showed them to his daughter, who urged me to read them to him. I read these words to him and learned later that he passed within the half hour. I call it virgin journey. This is not the first virgin journey you have taken. Your first play in the sandbox of words, that first time in the first foster home, first trip to the golden city, First sex, first kiss, first love, first fall, first flush of fatherhood, first stint on the Navy ship, first trip to your beloved Japan, first flight into novel writing, first time before a room full of students, first home you built with your own hands, first poetry published, first laureate accolade. It's all right if you're a little scared. Never kept you from going ahead before. I feel the fire in your bony hands, faltering hum of your heart, cold under your cap of silver, and I understand. It's all right. It's all right. Kaleidoscope of memories merging with dreams, wishes re-remembered, visions passing through, whispers of old loves whimpering in the dimming light, sounds of arrival and departure echoing in the deafening ear, chores unfinished, rattling at your feet, unpublished novels, unspoken gratitudes, time escaping through your grasping fingers. It's all right. It's all right. Just another virgin journey. Lean back. Let it happen. One more deep breath. Enjoy the trip. It's all right. It's all right now.
Vilma, it's been wonderful sitting here talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Catherine.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. You just heard an interview with Healdsburg, California literary laureate Vilma Ginsberg. Ginsberg read from her book, Colors of Glass. Up next is a poem written by Armando Garcia Davila, If I Loved You Yesterday. The poem is read by Javier Salmon, and the music is composed and performed by Ivan Rain, R-A-N-E.
If I love you yesterday, if I love you yesterday, I love you more today. If I love you dawn, then I love you all the more as the sun bids a good evening to the blue and green earth. I love you when hourglass is turned and one green follows another. I will love you more with each falling particle. until the last nestles atop the mound. If I love you with this breath, then I will love you all the more with the next. And then, with each batting of an eye, and with each flutter of the hummingbird's wing, I will love you again and more. I will heap my love for you after a day's labor, and sleep to dream of you, and awake to love you more than the night before. Because my love, if I love you yesterday, I love you more today.
This is Catherine Hastings, and that was a poem written by former Healdsburg Literary Laureate Armando Garcia Davila. The poem was read by Javier Salmon, S-A-L-M-O-N, with music composed and performed by Ivan Raine, R-A-N-E. Up next, San Francisco poet Dan Bellum reads from his new book, published by 16 Rivers Press, Practice. The book takes as its starting point the Jewish practice of studying weekly portions of the Torah in an annual cycle. The poems offer meditations on faith, doubt, yearning, family ties, love and loss, and the age-old roots of modern-day war. You're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Here now is Dan Bellum. Welcome, Dan. I'd like to start out by asking you to just talk a moment about the structure of your new book, Practice, which is a very interesting book, and it's different from any other collection of poems I've seen in the way that it is structured. Maybe you can talk about Midrash for a minute, and then also speak for a moment about the references at the end of each one of your poems.
Yes, the subtitle of the book I've given it is A Book of Midrash. And the references at the end of each poem are portions of the Torah, the first five books of the Hebrew Bible. And the Torah was divided into those portions over 2,000 years ago for the purpose of weekly study and reflection and public liturgy. And a whole school of Jewish biblical interpretation grew up equally long ago, which has come to be known as Midrash, which has sought to sort of imaginatively explain or expand the text, often beyond its literal meaning. So let me give you a couple of examples of what Midrash does. And I became attracted to it because I found a lot of commonality between Midrash and poetry, because there's lots of wordplay and ambiguity and sort of going after the unexplained or mysterious parts of the story and trying to figure out more. So, for example, a Midrashic question classically would be, which one was created first, heaven or earth? Because in the first two chapters of Genesis, there are two versions which seem to contradict each other. Or why does God say when creating heaven and earth, let us make man in our image, after our likeness? Who is God speaking to there? What is this plural? Another one might be, what was Sarah, Abraham's wife, thinking or doing when Abraham went off to the mountain to sacrifice their son? At God's command. She's not mentioned in that part of the story, but it's a question that begs to be asked. So modern poets, and I would point to Alicia Ostreicher as a wonderful practitioner of the art, modern poets and writers have brought Midrash into contemporary poetry. And I enjoy the practice myself, and it really became a practice over the past 10 years. And so this collection is organized basically around weekly portions from the Torah, sometimes closely related, sometimes very tangentially from a word or a phrase, sometimes taking the story head on, and sometimes going entirely in my own direction. I'll begin with the first poem in the book. And it, of course, refers to the Sabbath, refers the reader to the passages of the Torah in which we are commanded to observe the seventh day. And it also refers to a passage in the Exodus, that most frightening of the plagues, when a darkness fell on the land of Egypt. And we're told that it was a darkness that was beyond darkness. It could be felt. This is called parable. I lit the candles of the Sabbath and covered my eyes, terrified in the mind as I was, and waiting for rest. And the evening passed. And as they reached their end, the one became turbulent, sputtering, loud. The left one on the table, the one facing my heart, the heart of it burning out, impure and rough, a red with tarry shadows, spitting death at me. The other placid as prayer, clear light and patient in the copper hourglass bowl, steadfast as the soul of the one I love, soothing me, being also alive. And this one I knew would last and burn long tonight, the other flail down like madness and hard living of every sort, the darkness that is touched and felt. And I sighed for the love and sighed the poor candle out. Then I could rest, having yielded half the light. This one is called First Evening Prayer. The story of Jacob's ladder may be familiar to many people, Jewish and non-Jewish alike. The patriarch Jacob is on a journey and has a dream, or a waking vision, perhaps, of a kind of a ladder or stairway connecting earth and heaven, and angels going up and down on it. But he's also credited in the Jewish tradition with inventing the evening prayer. Before then, it was a daylight activity, but the legend goes that God caused the darkness to fall in order for them to have this encounter. So this is called First Evening Prayer. It is possible, even in the darkness, no, it is more possible. That is when your messenger comes to me, who has walked on appearing beside me like starlight in the day, angel that lives in the dust of the earth and knows the distance of time and the terrible space between one human and another that can hardly be crossed. In the dark, the messenger cries, "Lift your eyes up. What I am dreaming, I am seeing. It is coming to be." And climbs a coil, a rope, a spinning ladder that is the way into day in the night. A place of God I didn't know, here at the foot of it, the root of the tree, not for me to ascend, but to pray to you in the dark, that you have brought down the infinite to me, when my head lay on a stone, one earth wheeling among the millions of your stars. Well, this one is a home of parenthood. And one thing that parents traditionally do on the Sabbath is bless their children. There are particular words of a blessing that you say in the evening. And that blessing comes from the book of Genesis. It's the blessing that Jacob gives to his grandchildren, the sons of Joseph. This poem refers to that toward the end. It's called Blessing Him. In the old stories we tell each other to keep awake or help us sleep or mark the way by car to second grade and back, there is a hero and there is a test. Riddles are posed to him, mad questions asked, mazes of multiple choice. There is a wilderness to cross, a fast river, a sealed up house with a disguised way in and a spring to the lock. There is a spell. He doesn't know at first which power is going to help. Intelligence, force, cunning. So he carries all three in amounts that shift shape as he carries them, as he himself can change along the way, has trouble sticking to the story, the assignment, because all stories are connected and he slides, seeing he can enter another element, change the subject, become a creature of water or air. And then we've all but lost him. And then what spell is going to call him back? In the old stories, imposter parents set the hero to tasks, stealing his time from dreaming, can't see what kind of creature he is, can't comprehend his nature. A contemplative angel in white, wearing red lipstick, doing his nails black. No. He is sitting at the kitchen table, gripping his pencil with a fist, while I put away the shopping. Has to write a story for school with a set of seven words starting with S, and feels the separation between mind and hand. A trickster spirit that won't let him do what he knows how. Says in tears, because I have gotten mad, that he's no good at thinking of stories, no good at thinking. But here on the table beside him is a perfect report from the teacher, penciled in his own hand. In the old stories, for all the while, the hero is being tested, measured, evaluated, written up. The unforeseen right answer overthrows the one only thought right. There is a way out. In the old stories, there are proper words to say. We are sitting at the kitchen table, blessing him for Shabbat, placing the hands of fathers on his head and whispering into his ear the words of burden, hope, and vow. Yesemcha Elohim ke'Ephraim v'chimenashe. May God make you like the sons of Joseph and be gracious to you and give you peace. He stills his constant motion. He lets the hands rest on his head. He likes it. We don't know ourselves what power the words have in this story. Do we want him to be what we want if he has no way of knowing how? The candlelight, as he stares into it, lets him enter a little dream. He is only half tempted to blow it out. This one is a kind of coming out story, thinking back to the mid-1970s, and also thinking of that Jacob story of actually encountering a place or a moment that is an entryway to another world. The setting is coming back to Boston with a friend after a visit to Fire Island, which of course is a popular gathering place for gay people. And this was quite new to me as a man of about 22 at the time. This is called The Portal. Night had overtaken us before I could make my way home. That summer I had no home. The ferry had taken us from the island back to the mainland, the dominant land. All day in the sun I had seen men holding hands and not known in my mind what to feel or how to let imagine for me that touch of skin. The occasional lights of little towns were all that came out of the darkness at me in the back of the darkened bus. But he was sitting beside me, his friend I had loved 7 years. And after we stopped having words to say, once words could give no evasion, no use, we let silence come, a darkness new to me in which I was ready to be frightened, prepared all at once to give myself away. I wanted to reach inside and go, and took his hand and held my breath and felt my soul leave me and return as another, still myself, but not alone. And he pressed his hand back, no other part touching, and we needed no other. An hour I held it, and he too held on. A prayer there was no word for. Hands made entry to some world I had not known of, and would live in if I could. This one is a kind of Moses and the Burning Bush poem. This was my bar mitzvah portion. Every bar and bat mitzvah, traditionally done at age 13, although I had my bar mitzvah as an adult, I never had one as an adolescent. To prepare, you learn that week's portion of the Torah. So my portion was this story from the beginning of the book of Exodus, called The Voice in the Fire. Preparing to pray is in itself a prayer, or so I say. I will begin tomorrow. Having fled here, though none pursue, fled where? Within, far, to the desert place, the sorrow place, for what I have done, for surely the matter is known. But see, turn aside, look, the thorn tree, the heart is not consumed. Burning, it does not burn to ash. It has a voice. Friend, pilgrim, start now on your way. You can't save your prayer for the world to come, vagrant one. It is your call, the knowing to turn and answer. Wilderness of God, hard mountain, I am here. A pilgrim going to the farthest place is praying, or two can pray if the place be near, since going is the way. There are also a couple of translations in the book, and this one is a very short one. It's a four-line poem by the poet Paul Celan, written in German. I translate from Spanish and French. I don't know German, but I loved this poem, and I tried my hand at it, and I think of this as a burning bush poem, too, although I don't know whether Celan had that in mind or not. I know you. You're the one bent low. I, your servant, am the one pierced through. Where, to vouch for us both, will a word flame free? You, so completely real, hallucinate me. This one, many people will remember the story of the Israelites worshiping a golden calf. Moses, of course, had been up on the mountain for so long, receiving the commandments and speaking to God, that the rest of the people got nervous and felt that they had been abandoned, felt the need to create a God of their own. This poem, which sort of works with that story, is also touches on an incident that people of a certain age like mine might remember. It's called Falling. Abbie Hoffman throws dollar bills onto the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, August 24th, 1967. Bright midday in the theater of the soul. It began falling. The building stirred a bit. His anger flared up when he saw it. The money. Building stirred a bit. As soon as he came near and saw it, the startled capitalists, the frenzy, said the Daily News next day. The falling money. They stopped what they were doing for a minute. It was falling. Stopped buying and selling the earth and scrambled for the money. There was a yipping sound, fighting each other over the ones and the fives, a Jew in the visitor's gallery, until they saw what they were doing and looked up. The building stirred a bit. Sexy in his sacrilegious shirt, he took the calf they had made and burned it with fire. American flag for a shirt. Hurled the tablets of the law from his hands, brought the whole big board to a halt. I mean, you can give a 10-page speech against imperialism, and the earth, too, stirred a bit. And everybody listens and says, yeah, yeah, go dye the Potomac red. But you throw money onto the New York Stock Exchange. He ground the molten calf to powder. People get that right away. They stopped what they were doing and looked up. And they say, right, I understand what that's about. He strewed the gold upon the water and made them drink it. The portion is Ki Tisa, Exodus chapter 30, verse 11 to chapter 34, verse 35. And if you go to the New York Stock Exchange to this day as a visitor, you'll see that you can go up to the gallery, but there's a barrier, there's a big plexiglass barrier, and the reason that that's there is because of this, so that people won't conduct political guerrilla theater and throw dollar bills down. Maybe it was clear before that one of the poems I read earlier was a sonnet. There are a number of sonnets in this book, and here are a couple more. These are for my father, and I wrote this sonnet called Practice. How simple it ought to be to practice compassion on someone gone, even love him long as he's not right there in front of me. For I turned to address him as I do and saw that no one's lived in that spot for quite some time. O turner away of prayer, not much of a god, but he was never meant to be. For the seventh time I light him a candle, an entire evening and morning it burns, not a light to see by, more a reminder of light, a remainder in a glass with a prayer on the label and a barcode from the store. How can he go on? Can't. Then let him pass away. He gave what light he could. What more will I claim? What debt of grace he doesn't owe? If I forgive him, he is free to go. And this one is called Repair. It came from a dream. It was one of those dreams that are so vivid it felt like a visitation. He woke up from his death inside my sleep because he couldn't just lie there anymore. What with getting the damn place back into shape if no one else will. And the house I was born in took form again in my dream to receive his help. He stood on a ladder at an open door, poorly balanced up on the highest step, fixing something invisible, while the war we'd started blared on the TV. We knew that Mom was inside, lost, hiding, losing her mind somewhere, going infinitely away, and who was left but us. So now, for once, in the end, we would talk to each other, figure what to do, love her together, and he would be my friend. This one's a memory from the 50s, and it's perhaps appropriate in a presidential election year. It's called Milk. Early in the morning, 3 days a week when I was 5, a man would come fill the metal rack on the porch with bottles of milk and take away the empties. Sometimes I'd watch him through the kitchen window, a small, shy face at a barely parted curtain, peeking and hiding. His name was Ike, and he would wink at me, as if caught in a secret, doing something he should not, and sure I wouldn't tell, and hum a little scrap of tune to seal the agreement, and walk off with the tip of his cap. It's true. I haven't told until now. Most every afternoon he got his name into the Daily Register. It often floated in the air, spoken above my head. He was the president, but had a separate early morning life, and I knew of it, contented that the world was made this way. 3 days a week, the president got up before dawn and visited me, going door to door to make himself of use. Now I have to say that politicians have never quite lived up to that early impression of them, but I still hope. The final section of the book is, addressed, I guess, inevitably, not just a spirituality, but religion and politics and how these play out. And specifically, there's a long sequence of sonnets that are linked together called the Book of Numbers. And they're prompted by the 10 portions of that book. There are 10 linked sonnets. And I found myself, the war in Iraq was starting in 2003, as the Book of Numbers was coming around in the annual cycle. And it's such a warlike book. And over, it was reminding me, it was bringing me to the present day, and the present day was bringing me back to the Book of Numbers. I was seeing these uncomfortable parallels. One of them, this one is called Milk and Honey. And of course, one of the great problems the Israelites had, according to the story in the Bible, when they left slavery in Egypt, is that they were approaching a promised land God was promising to them. The troubling part of it was that there were people already living in that promised land. So what were they going to do about that? And at one point, they're approaching this land, and they send out spies and scouts to see what's happening there, see what they have to contend with. And among other things, the people living there are the descendants of Esau. Esau was the brother of Jacob, who had the blessing stolen away from him. And there's a reference to the town of Hebron, which is, to this day, it's an ancient city. It's mentioned in the Bible, and to this day, it's a overwhelmingly Arab city on the West Bank. This is called Milk and Honey. Oh, dear God, the land you have promised us already has people living in it. And why didn't we hear that part before the Exodus? So this is the choice, to live as slaves or die as slaves to war. Now think, some other place you haven't got? We sent out men to spy for us. A sorry lot who claim a race of giants lives up there, but what a lie. Most likely, long-lost relatives. Hebron's a town as old as Esau, walled with stones they'll gladly throw at us, blood brothers or not. Couldn't we come in peace, share what we've got, including you, settle down and call it off? But no, you answer, you must dispossess them all. Later that year, this is still 2003, I was back in Illinois, where I grew up, and it was the 4th of July, and my nephew, who was in Iraq at the beginning of the war, was coming home safely from his tour of duty there. This was back when the president was still declaring mission accomplished and soldiers were actually coming home. So there was a homecoming, and it was the 4th of July, and we're in a very conservative city, and the portion from Numbers that week is all about zealotry and slaughter. This poem is called Illinois, July 4th. Our boy has come home, but the war doesn't go away, O sons of Peoria, by wishing it so. An answered prayer. God bless the USA, where at least I know I'm free. But do we know? We hardly ask, and our soldier doesn't say much what he's seen or done. We have a ways to go. There are songs of exaltation and zealotry downtown at dusk, bombs bursting in air to show us who we are, forever asking God to unbless someone else. Oh, awful pride of nationhood, resentful, paranoid, a little desperate, as if the one who heard all prayer were some diligent American God, numbering the living and the dead. I'll read the last one in the book. Many people will remember, of course, the turning of the millennium when we feared that there might be some great technological disaster, that the computers weren't going to be ready, that many things would shut down, that something almost apocalyptic was going to happen. So this is a poem I wrote actually on New Year's Day, 2000. And it's called The Turning. I was also thinking of the portion Nitzavim toward the end of the book of Deuteronomy. This is a great sort of farewell speech Moses is giving to the people. He knows he's not going to enter the promised land, and he's giving them their final instructions because he knows he's going to die on this side of the river. And among other things that he says in this great poetic passage is, I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day. I have put before you life and death, blessing and curse. Choose life if you and your offspring would live. This poem is called The Turning. 1-0, and nothing happened. Where the nothing that might have didn't. Power and light, the track of time, haven't failed you yet. There ought to be a lesson in it, of entrusting the heart to the day and the hour, not turning backward with dread or forward with regret. Your heart endures and beats 0-1, 0-1. And the soul, whatever you have done, endures. It too prepared, almost without you, for the turning of the time, calling out, then waiting, like the call of being, then its shadow, asking you choose one, though you felt unready, even half yearning for total system collapse. But let it be said, there came a turning, and you lived instead.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you've been listening to Dan Bellum reading from his new book of poems, Practice. Practice was published recently by 16 Rivers Press. If you'd like to hear Dan Bellum read live, he'll be reading at the Sonoma County Book Festival in Santa Rosa on Saturday, September 20th this year.
One of my favorite poets of all time is William Butler Yeats, and one of my favorite singers is the late contralto Kathleen Ferrier. Ferrier was born in Lancashire, England, in 1912, and died just 41 years later after becoming one of the best-loved and most admired singers in the world. It gives me immense pleasure to play a recording of Kathleen Ferrier singing the art song Down by the Sally Gardens, a poem by William Butler Yeats.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. My guests tonight were Vilma Ginsberg, Dan Bellum, Armando Garcia Davila with Javier Salmon and Ivan Rain, and you just heard Kathleen Ferrier sing Down by the Sally Gardens, a poem by William Butler Yeats. If you have any questions or comments about tonight's show, please contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.